Let's call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record indicate that it is 1:33 p.m., a.m., Thursday, March 24th, 2016. 9:33. Okay, present today we have Representative Wilson, Representative Kawasaki, Vice Chair Representative Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Munoz, Representative Gaddis, and we'll have a couple more joining us shortly. Before we start, please no cell phones or electronic devices in the committee room. On today's schedule, we will have a second hearing of three bills. House Bill 231, Extend Board of Parole, by Representative Lynn. House Bill 222, Increase of Appropriation Items, bill by Representative Hawker. And House Bill 77, Disability, License, and Training Requirements, by myself, Representative Thompson. If it's the will of the committee, I plan to move all three of these bills out today. And then we will have our first hearing on House Bill 247, Tax Credits, Interest, Refunds, Oil and Gas, by the Rules Committee at request of the Governor. Our first order of business today is House Bill 231, Extend the Board of Parole. We have a CS on House Bill 231. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would... Mr. Chairman, I move that we bring CS for HB 231 Finance Version 29-LS1138-H before the committee for discussion.
Are there any objections? We will be addressing the CS. Ms. Pearson, will you please come to the table and put the changes on the record?
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. And the change in this was to shorten the extension date from, I think it was 2022, to 2019. That will give us 3 years before it comes before us again. This is a board that may go through changes if we change the way we deal with our criminal statutes.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So by changing this, do they have to have a complete audit done again, just like they did this year?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes.
And a follow-up?
Representative Wilson.
And what is the cost? What was the cost of this year's?
Chris Curtis is in the audience, and she could probably answer that question for you.
I'd like to get the answer from whomever we need to.
Okay, Representative Pruitt has joined us. Any further questions on the CS? Hearing none. From the sponsor's office, we have staff Esther Milkey. Please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and if you have anything you would like to put on the record regarding House Bill 231.
Hello, my name is Esther Milkey, staff to Representative Lynn. We have no further comments.
All right. Any questions from the committee? You want to?
Chris Curtis.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi there.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor, and Representative Wilson through the chair. In response to how much the audit cost, I'm going to guess. I think it was about 700 hours to do the audit. Around $70 an hour is our FY15, I believe, hourly cost. $49,000 is, I'm guessing, around that, around $50,000.
Representative Wilson.
So if we were to have kept the date where it was and changes happened because of bills coming through, I guess I'm just trying to figure out whether that would have really made a difference to the audit, because we could still make changes to the parole board and still extend their sunset. Those would just happen in the normal process through statute.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, if you're asking whether you can make changes to the parole board outside of the sunset process, absolutely. Yeah, our office has really no opinion about the sunset date, and it's the call of whether the extra cost is worth it would fall upon the policymakers.
Representative Wilson.
And I guess the other question is, I know that, you know, it may have taken longer. How long the audits are apart, does that influence the cost? Because the last sunset was a lot longer than this one. So would we still be looking at about a $50,000 cost when we're only looking at 3 years versus if it was an 8-year sunset?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, typically if we come in a short period of time, it will be a faster audit. However, because of the changes, dramatic changes to the landscape, so to speak, it could be a longer audit, looking at the workload and what they're doing and the impact of the board and how they're serving the public's interest. So I really couldn't tell. But if everything stays the same, typically the audit will be less time.
Thank you.
Representative Gehr has joined us. Representative Guttenberg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly going through your audit, there's four recommendations in there. I know how sometimes subtle your wording can be, but I'm pretty concerned when you say that the parole board files didn't consistently contain all required information. That's recommendation number one. Recommendation number two, notifications to be provided for offenders and victims were not sufficiently documented. Number three, board changes to the regulations did not address statutory requirements. And number four, the audit contained several ACOMS deficiencies that could affect security and consistency of data. How severe do you see these for the functioning of the parole board, and how far out of alignment are they from normal practices?
Representative Guttenberg, through the chair, I would say that none of those four recommendations impacted our recommendation for extension. We would have recommended the full 8 years, which is the maximum allowed for in statute, had we not been concerned about the need for oversight, mainly because they had changed the risk assessment tool, right towards the end of our audit scope, and really couldn't see the impact on that and really been able to evaluate it. So that was mainly the reason. We didn't really consider SB 91 too much in our recommendation. That was new last year. It was just right out of the gate. And so, the board itself, we found was operating fairly well, fairly efficient, fairly professional. And these are more administrative type, housekeeping type of things. Whenever we go in, we try to make things better. And so it was more documentation and procedures. We looked at how willing they were to make changes, where they were at on making changes by the time we left, how quickly they responded. So I would say that none of those four recommendations impacted our extension.
Another question. Representative Guttenberg.
A lot of it seems to be filing and notification things. Are they missing somebody in their office? Are they missing a filing clerk? Is there something missing that preventing them from operating as efficiently?
Through the chair, it really, I think, mainly is the interaction between the board and the department. And some of the documentation issues are how they interact with institutional COs, hopefully that's the right term, correctional officers, and to what degree they document, to what degree they're using effectively the management system to document. So it wasn't necessarily missing a staff person as opposed to coordination between departments or the board and the department.
For training?
Training, even just being aware of where they're at and a willingness to improve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions of Ms. Curtis, the auditor? Seeing none, thank you very much. Okay. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 231? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Nobody online. Seeing nobody in the room, nobody online, I will now close public testimony. Committee, questions or comments? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not going to stop this bill from going forward, but I guess I just am uncomfortable that knowing our fiscal issue right now that we're going to – I guess I was comfortable with the date they already had on here and that the audit would be accomplished. We'd see what difference SB 91 did, but I guess I don't see any red flags that would, for me, would constitute that moving this date to where it's only 3 years. And I understand there's a lot of moving pieces, but I believe all those could be done. We could still do the checks and balances to see how they were doing without adding more work to the auditors, because we have all the normal ones that are going to be going on this. So I guess I just would have preferred to kept the same way, but it's up to the committee how they want to go with it. Thank you.
We took into consideration pending legislation that can really change what we're going to be doing in the future with this, and so that's why we decided that we'd better take another look.
What was the original date?
All right. Is there any further discussion by committee? Seeing no further discussion, Representative Guerra.
Yeah. Actually, I do agree with Representative Wilson. If she was talking about not making them come back 3 years from now. I mean, the truth is, during these board extensions, we don't have as much impact as we think that we do, and it takes time, it takes money to have them come before us too frequently. I guess I would prefer a 5-year board extension, and if they do something terrible, we can always do something about it. Mr. Chair, I guess I would move a conceptual amendment to extend it to 2021.
Okay. Discussion on a conceptual amendment to move it to 2021, which would make it a 5-year extension. Representative Munoz?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I thought you had your hand up. Is there any objection to the conceptual amendment? Hold on. Representative Guerra, any further discussion on?
Was there an objection?
Nope, there is no objection. I thought you wanted to make a statement.
Nope.
Seeing no objection, the conceptual amendment to change this to the 2021 date is approved by committee. And at this time, we're back to the amended CS. Is there any further discussion? All right, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can you walk us through the fiscal note?
Thank you. Assuming that the change in duration of the extension has no effect, HB 231 has a single fiscal note from the Department of Corrections. It's OMB component number 6905, dated 3/15 of 2016, which calls for $1,017,500 from UGF, fund source 1004, and $1,019,400 from interagency receipts.
Okay,
yeah, from fund source 1007. There's a total ongoing expense of $1,019,400, which is a continuation of the existing funding.
All right. Can I have a motion to move House Bill 231 from committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move the House Bill CS for HB 231 Finance, Version 29-LS1138/H, an act extending the termination date. Coming. An act extending the termination date of the Board of Parole, providing for an effective date as amended, from the House Finance Committee with committee recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objection? Hearing none, then House Bill 231 moves from Finance Committee. We'll take a brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Next, we have House Bill 222, Increase of Appropriation Item. This bill is by Representative Hawker, and we have a CS before us. Representative Sadler, can I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for HB 222 Finance version 29-LS1045-H, version Martin and Wallace dated 3/23/16 before the committee for discussion purposes.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, Ms. Pearson, would you please come to the table, explain the differences?
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Thompson. The CS before you changes the 45-day limit to 90 days, thereby giving the legislature a little bit more time to look at this. They can always choose to accept it in a day, but it just gives the time for the legislature to do their duty, and Julie Lucky can give you more detail on this.
Any questions of Ms. Pearson? Thank you very much. Ms. Lucky, staff for Representative Hawker, is here to refresh us on the bill and explain some of the differences.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Julie Lucky, and I'm staff for Representative Mike Hawker, District 28, who sends his regrets for not being able to be here today. As you may recall from last week, the bill does codify a process for the legislature during the budgeting process to prohibit using the RPL process to increase an appropriation in the budget. As Ms. Pearson stated, the CS does extend the waiting period to 90 days, so therefore, if the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee were to get an RPL, they would have the executive branch would have to wait 90 days before expending that RPL unless the committee took action to hasten that timeline by approving the RPL. I'm not sure if there are some additional questions.
Questions of Ms. Lucky, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be unfair for me not to say this, which Ms. Lucky's daughter Charlotte is here, and I think Charlotte would like to tell the Anchorage School Board not to close Inlet View Elementary School.
A little off subject, but I like this, yes.
Which I agree with her on, so thank you.
Further questions to Ms. Lucky? Seeing none, thank you very much. And at this time, I would like to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on House Bill 222? Seeing none, is there anybody online? Nobody in the room or online. We will close public testimony. Representative Sadler, walk the committee through the fiscal note?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. HB 222 has a zero fiscal note from the legislature. OMB component number 775, dated 3/16/2016.
Zero. All right. What is the will of the committee? Representative Sadler, can I have a motion to move House Bill 222 from committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for HB 222 Finance from House Finance Committee with committee individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Object.
We have an objection. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate everything that Ms. Lucky presented to us on the bill, and I understand that there are merits to it. My worry with this bill is that nobody would have thought of this bill if it wasn't for the Medicaid expansion debate last year, right? And nobody's saying that this bill is to stop Medicaid expansion. And so that part we can leave to the side. But the current process allows the state to accept basically grant funds that come in that fit within something that we've agreed to appropriate for. So it's more money that the state doesn't pay for, either the feds will pay for or a private donor will pay for, or we get grant money, or maybe it's the Mental Health Trust Authority. I don't think that we can think ahead and figure out what kind of money we might lose out on in the future. And I think we might be sort of stepping over ourselves by passing this bill. Maybe it's going to be renewable energy money that's needed to complete a project that all of a sudden we won't accept. If this bill were in place last year and we didn't accept the Medicaid expansion money, we'd have lost out on, in a state that's teetering on recession, if not in a recession, we would have lost out on $140 million of federal funding that is rippling through this economy, sort of helping us not sink as an economy. Much of the budget that we have that we passed, a lot of the cuts are cuts because we have extra money coming in because of that Medicaid expansion decision. I know there's $5.7 million of cuts in behavioral health because that money is now being leveraged through the new federal law. But in the future, we don't know what this is going to prevent the state from accepting. We just don't know. And it's not money that the state pays for. This bill has to do with money that comes in from another source for something that fits with something that we approved. So I think there are going to be unintended consequences. I think 30 years from now we'll look back and we'll find out that we blocked a project that we could have used by passing this bill. I don't know what that's going to be. But I don't think the law needs to be changed. So I'm going to oppose this bill.
Further discussion, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So a few years ago, we had a lot of stimulus money that came through. And for years, then, we ended up looking, after we took the money, on how those projects went and backfilling and whether or not to backfill. Although I know the legislature at the time said that, you know, we weren't going to backfill, so go ahead and take that money. Well, that didn't turn out to be reality. From my understanding, what this bill does, it doesn't disallow the money. There's still a process that you have to go through. We just, as a legislature, have a better understanding of what that money is for and whether or not we want it to go forward versus right now where things go through, then we try to figure out where the money came from, whether or not we're going to be able to keep the program going. And I think this is just being more proactive, especially in a time when we don't know where additional state dollars may go. So I don't see it as a blocking of any kind of money. I see as we're doing our due diligence in a better way. So I am in favor of this bill going forward.
Vice Chair Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While certainly the issue, this bill comes up as a result of a dispute which had incidentally as its nexus the Medicaid expansion issue. The issue is not Medicaid expansion. The issue is clearly the legislature's appropriations authority and the proper balance between the executive and legislative branches. I think this legislation does allow the legislature the improved opportunity to consider what accepting more money through the RPL process means, and I think it's therefore appropriate, and I will support the measure as presented.
Bill under further discussion. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I can't say every appropriation, but certainly every department that we debated in the state budget, there was a program or an allocation or something out there where we cut it and we said go find more money. Go out and seek and find and come back and be more efficient and have more match money. Although I'm not sure we don't do it statutorily, we certainly have done it in spirit. You know, to make the government more responsive, more ability, the governor when we're not in session to function with more efficiencies, and this is a pullback from that. That's my concern is, you know, we told the governor, go out, and all the commissioners and all the deputy commissioners and everybody that testified in front of us about find more money, go out and get it someplace else. It might not be spot on to what the program is. It might be offset a little bit or something else completely that supplements or does something. But now we're telling him we're not going to give you the flexibility that we did the entire budget under. Now we're changing the rules. I don't think that's what we want to do. You know, in this time with our budget situation, the flexibility and the ability to respond and do things is what we want to do, not what we want to contract on. So that's the basis of my objection, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Under discussion, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, in the American system of government, the legislative body is granted the power of the purse. Whether it's the federal side, whether it's the state side, the power of appropriations lies within the legislative body. Doesn't mean is that only state money that we're appropriating or a certain class of money. Any money that goes through, in our case, the state, is appropriated by the legislature. And so I feel that this discussion that we're having is is rethinking whether or not we have given up the ability of the legislature to maintain and hold that power of the purse. Now, why does the legislature have the power of the purse? Because we're the closest to the people. We are more directly, because of the way that we represent a smaller group of people, we have a more direct connection than an administration or a governor. And so with that in mind, no matter how we got to this conversation, that we recognize that there was a situation where we had ceded our authority as the closest to the people to another branch of government. And I think that's what this bill is recognizing and correcting that scenario. It's putting the power of appropriations, the power of the purse, back into the hands essentially of the people, because we are a closer connection to the people. So does it mean that things will stop? No, it doesn't. That would make the assumption that the LBNA committee is going to stop every single ask for federal receipts or any sort of receipts. And as someone who has sat on LBNA now for a year and a half, that in general, that is not something that happens. Most RPLs that come before the LBNA committee, whether it's for additional state money, whether it's for federal funds that come through, are generally approved. And if I'm incorrect, the chair also sits, and he can correct me on that. And so I think saying that this is going to stop things from going forward, whether it's 2 years from now or 30 years from now, is probably not a correct depiction of the experience that I've had in my time sitting on LBNA. So I think this is an appropriate measure and decision for us to make, is to put the power back in essentially the hands of the people, of the purse, of the appropriations. So I appreciate the representative from District 28 bringing this forward.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad there's the acknowledgement that this was purely brought up as an issue because of Medicaid expansion, and because we as a legislative body have the power of the purse, and sometimes we disagree with the governor. But I think that, you know, while we might disagree with the governor on some issues, this is one pretty simple separation of powers that he actually has, and his ability to accept federal funds on behalf of the rest of the state. What I fear is that a program like early education, which is something that the U.S. government's looking at right now, federal government's looking at granting states certain pre-K dollars, that particular issue could come up in the middle of the summer. We're now basically giving a 90 days before the state can accept or could accept those funds, when we might in fact want them earlier. What could happen is that a chairman that represents 17,000 people or a senator who represents twice as many people could decide they don't like pre-K, they don't value pre-K. The governor has that opportunity, representing the rest of the state, to say this is something we would really like to see, and we have no way of accepting those funds, barring the chair's responsiveness and willingness to bring that forward. So I think there are some circumstances in which this could be very difficult, and so I would just agree with the maker of the objection. Thanks.
Jenny Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think it's possible to overthink this change. I mean, this is a simple change. It's adding 45 days of review time to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee when accepting new grant monies. I think it's an appropriate change, and one that I support. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to ask the sponsor, Ms. Milkey, could you come up and I'm going through too many things here. Ms. Lucky, please come forward and maybe give us a little clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, again, Julie Lucky, staff to Representative Mike Hawker, District 28. This is, I think, exactly the policy discussion that Representative Hawker would like to see about this bill, is about the separation of powers and the power of the purse versus the power to spend the money, which the governor has. I would like to point out just a couple of things. The first is, if the power to accept additional federal funding is not a power that the governor is granted by the Constitution, but a power granted via the legislature by the statute that we are proposing to amend. And again, it is reconsidered every year by those of you that read the full budget. I know it's just one section of a very large document, but it is also granted every year. So the legislature at any point could choose to not include Section 24 into the budget and by just a quick budget amendment not allow the governor to accept any federal funds during the interim at all. That is done, as I understand, in at least one state. I was not unable to look at all 50 states, but I did do as much as I could. And I believe the state of Arizona, they have to call back into special session anytime additional federal funds come in. In a lot of other states, LBNA, their version of the LBNA committee has more power to accept or reject, and that would be based on the differences in the constitutional balance of powers. Within our system, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee does not have the power to reject the acceptance of funds, and that's why we have this two-step process today, which is we grant the power via the budget every year, and then we put a process in place, which is what we are proposing to amend. The only thing that I would point out is that the power isn't absolute. The power is limited. As Mr. Thiel had mentioned in the last budget, in the last hearing in this committee, it was actually it used to be allowed for general funds, but that the legislature decided to amend the budget one year to not allow general funds, and the RPL process is not available for those funds right now. It's not my job or my duty to discuss the policy. That's firmly on your heads. I just wanted to put a few facts in front of you about how the process works and the fact that we grant this power and we have limited this power in the past. The process envisioned by House Bill 222 would be a specific prohibition on a specific budget item, not necessarily, it's not a blanket prohibition on many items. It was the intent of Representative Hawker that if the legislature as the appropriating body had considered a particular appropriation and determined not to move forward with that appropriation, that they have the power to restrict that in the budget and therefore not necessarily prohibit the governor or the executive branch or the state from taking advantage of that additional money, but rather have a process where the full legislature, as opposed to however many members are sitting on LBNA, could make any important policy decision that had already been considered but rejected by the entire legislature. And that, unless there are any further questions, Mr. Chairman, that's the only comments we have.
We do have one question, Ms. Lucky. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lucky, thank you. I think the term is the policymaking decisions are below your pay grade. but my question is, the first change in the bill, line 4 on page 1, unless expressly prohibited by language in the appropriation. So let's say that the legislature adopted the budget last year that said there'll be no Medicaid expansion. And the courts have ruled that expansion was mandatory. Would there have been a conflict? Where would the conflict have been? Has that been a discussion on a situation like
this? I don't think this is a discussion that we need to get into at this time about Medicaid expansion.
Okay, let me phrase it another way, Mr. Chairman. Never mind Medicaid, because that's passed. But I was trying to use that as an example. What happens if we put language in the budget that says no money shall be taken for Program X, and the federal government says it's mandatory, but we have said no? Where is the conflict? How is that resolved?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, I am not a constitutional scholar, and I believe we do have legislative legal online. I would prefer, if they are online, that they answer that question. However, I'll be happy to try my best if they are unavailable.
We don't have them online.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
So I think there's probably, we may be mixing the conversation though. The first line there is expressly, it relates to the part that Ms. Lucky mentioned that's in the budget where we place that we can accept the federal funds. And it says, unless we expressly prohibit by not including that section, this here it's section I think 24 Ms. Lucky mentioned, unless we were to choose to not include that, then you go through the process. So I think there's probably a mix of issues here. We give the authority for that federal funds, and now we're adding the second step. If we just didn't ask for the authority, then we don't even need this step, because we have said that there's not even the authority for the administration to accept that federal money. So I think that gets a little bit away from a court decision, because we'd have to start off with not choosing to accept any additional federal funds during the interim to begin with. I think that...
Mr. Chair, that was my point. If we specifically said in there, in the budget, don't accept these funds, and on the federal side of an appropriation, we could say that they're mandatory, how is that resolved? You're our scholar now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guttenberg, I believe that would be resolved the way that we resolve anything regarding the balance of powers. If you think about how this bill, and I think it might be two different discussions, how this bill would relate is only saying you cannot use the RPL process to accept the funds. I believe that if the legislature chose not to accept funds in the budget process or in any process that the federal government required us to accept, then that by its very nature would have to be litigated, but not necessarily. What we are doing in this bill is just saying the RPL process is not an appropriate avenue for a particular thing.
We do have legal online. They just called in. Hello, are you there?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. This is Megan Wallace from Ledge Legal.
Yes, we do have a question for you from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Wallace. In the CS before us, on page 1, line 4, unless expressly prohibited language of the appropriation. So we pass a budget. I'm assuming you weren't listening before, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself. If we pass a budget that says specifically this appropriation, we cannot accept federal money for this appropriation. And then on the federal side, the accepting that appropriation is required. How is that resolved? The conflict.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it's a hard question to answer in a hypothetical context. It would depend on what program you're talking about and what the Alaska statute said in regards to that program. This language would prevent, hypothetically, an increase to an existing appropriation. And so if you had a program that was funded in the budget and then additional federal dollars for that program came in, but the legislature had chosen to put in language that prevented or prohibited the acceptance of those additional funds, likely you would turn to the statute to see what happens. Is that additional federal funds needed to fully fund that program? And if that's the case, what happens in the event that the program is not fully funded? And so those are kind of considerations that would need to be taken into account if this process was enacted and used in that way.
All right, Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Seeing no further discussion on this, is the objection maintained? All right, can we have a roll call?
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Gaddis.
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg.
No.
Representative Kawasaki.
No.
Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Representative Pruitt.
Yes.
Representative Sadler.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
6 yeas, 3 nays.
By a vote of 6 yea and 3 nay, we have moved House Bill 222 from committee. We'll do a brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. Next we have House Bill 77, Disability, ID, License, and Training Requirements, sponsored by myself, Rep. Thompson. Here to refresh the committee on House Bill 77 is Jane Pearson from my staff. Ms. Pearson, please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and briefly refresh the committee on House Bill 77.
For the record, my name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson. And House Bill 77, the goal is to improve communications between law enforcement professionals who interact with people with who have non-apparent hidden disabilities. Whether these individuals encounter the system as victims, witnesses, or alleged perpetrators. The bill has three parts. There is a training component. There is a voluntary mark that can be placed on a license. So when the license is given to a law enforcement officer, there is notice that the person has a hidden disability. And the third part of the bill is to add a brief part in the driver's manual that talks about what to do when pulled over. This would be the very basics, and there could be a question on the driver's test coming up. And that is basically what the bill does.
Does the committee have any questions for Ms. Pearson? Seeing none, thank you very much, Ms. Pearson. And we will now go to public testimony. For starting in online, we have Rick Webb calling in from Fairbanks. Mr. Webb, are you there?
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I'm Rick Webb. I live in Fox. I'm a constituent of Representative Guttenberg. And I just want to voice my support for this bill. I believe it's very important to education is so important. And people have preconceived ideas of what they think is truth, and it's amazing how often, you know, that's wrong. And, you know, this is a voluntary program, and it's an opt-in, opt-out, no cost, and it's about fairness. It's not a get out of jail free. And I want to mention a story. I have a friend, he's in a wheelchair, and several years ago he had been to his parents' 50th wedding anniversary, had imbibed, was driving, and was all over the road, and people called in, and anyway, he got pulled over, and he was driving intoxicated. But the police didn't know how to interact with him because of him being in a wheelchair. And because of that, they had, you know, being handcuffed, you know, for safety purposes, which is, you know, standard procedure. The officers had to carry him everywhere because he couldn't wheel his wheelchair and didn't have, you know, was kind that didn't have the handles, you know, for to be pushed or anything. Anyway, he didn't get his phone call, and therefore he got off on a technicality. And that's he blew a .272, so he was way beyond, you know, the legal limit. And if the officers had been educated, you know, they would have known how to interact with somebody in a wheelchair, and they would have been able to make provisions so that that technicality, you know, didn't occur. And so I just wanted to stress this is about equal treatment, not special treatment, and, you know, that it's not, we're not asking for a get out of jail free. You know, the safety of everyone is the number one priority, and that, you know, we're just looking for fairness. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Webb. Also online we have Juanita Webb, are you there? Please place yourself on the record.
Yes, my name is Juanita Webb. I live in Fox, Alaska, in the interior. And I just wanted to take a moment to thank you for hearing this bill and working on it and the conversations that have been had. Like Rick, I've been personally involved in a story that I shared with you at the first hearing that you had last week, I believe it was. So I understand the importance of this bill, being part of Wallbusters that originally brought this bill forward. You know, we've been working on it diligently for 3 years. We appreciate Representative Thompson's office and the hard work and dedication that they've put into it. And, you know, basically the basis of everything is knowledge, and that's what this bill is about educating on all sides, not just law enforcement, but also people with disabilities and the general public. So it's a win-win for everybody. So thank you for your time and efforts put into this, and please vote yes to pass this along.
Thank you, Ms. Webb, for your testimony. Still under public testimony, do we have anybody in the room? Seeing none in the room, I know we have one other person online. We have Chad Godin from the Alaska State Troopers in Sitka to answer questions. But at this time, seeing none, we will close public testimony and go back to the committee. Does the committee have questions? Representative Wilson.
I do, too, if we have somebody for questions. My only concern, I like the bill. I'm a co-sponsor of the bill. I just guess I'm concerned that we're just going to have identification with no backup for the officer to understand what the disability is. The one, in, you know, so I would just like to know whether that seems to be an issue, that all they'll see is an indication that there is something going on, but whether they see potential problems of not knowing what that is when they make a stop. You said there was an officer online that could...
Yes, there is an officer online. I believe that this didn't want to start pointing out people's disabilities, but it would show that then the conversation can start with an officer and a person that got stopped. But I have Chad Godin online. Mr. Godin, I'm sorry if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. Are you there?
That's quite all right, sir.
Yeah, place yourself on the record.
Yes, my name is Lieutenant Chad Godin. I am the commander of the Department of Public Safety Training Academy here in Sitka and an Alaska State Trooper.
Did you hear Ms. Wilson's or Representative Wilson's question?
I did, and I certainly understand the concern. It becomes an issue of balancing privacy over helping the officer make the best decision based on the information that we have. And, you know, since this is a voluntary opt-in, opt-out, perhaps a provision could be made, and this is just me kind of thinking out loud on this issue, as to how much information they wish to have volunteered. And obviously there's only so much room on a license, but if this information is put in absent in as well as the license, there could be more information put there for dispatchers to relay to the officers before the officer even has a chance to look at the license.
Representative Wilson?
And thank you for that answer, and maybe that's something we need to look at. And I understand the privacy portion, but it was brought to my attention as we've been looking at this bill that there are some issues where even with a designation, some get very, very nervous when they're stopped by the police, and they may have a hard time trying to get out what the disability is or may not even know how to do it in the right way. And so, you know, maybe this could be done in regulation, because, again, it's voluntary, and I'm absolutely fine with that. But if someone who doesn't have a card they can pull out to say what their issue is and wants to do that so that maybe it's not so traumatic when they get stopped and there's a little bit more understanding, because I don't want to mandate it either. I just want to make sure it's on record that there are sometimes that even with a designation, more information could make everything go much smoother. So we'll work with the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to make this bill more perfect, you would make it more imperfect, right? If you had to list everybody's disabilities, number one, that might be a privacy issue. Number two, it might be a feasibility issue. Can you really write everything on a license? But if the license is marked, the way the bill is written right now, the officer will know that the person has some sort of disability, and then the officer will then try and find out what it is. So I think the bill, the way it's written right now, actually strikes a better balance. It lets the officer and the passenger have a conversation. It lets the officer figure out what the problem is, and that's the whole purpose of the bill. It alerts the officer that there is an issue that they need to sort of be more sensitive about, and they figure it out. And we all know officers and troopers, and you know, they tend to be high-performing people, and I think they will be able to figure that out. So I like the way the bill is written better now than requiring some sort of either too big of a statement on a license or something that maybe somebody doesn't want to put on their license. So I like the way the bill's written now. I think it works.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also a co-sponsor and do support the bill and its intent. But I just want to put in the record that I do have some concerns that we don't place too much of the responsibility for a positive outcome between a disabled person and police on the police. I would encourage people with disabilities to, and those that love them, to make sure and take other steps to make sure that the police might know about their loved one's situation. You can certainly meet with your local police officers or school resource officers to have a conversation and familiarize each with the other. I would consider people to wear bracelets, which might be a little more obvious than having to reach into your pocket for a driver's license or ID card that might tip the responding public safety officer that this might be a person who might require a little bit different handling. And also just generally I would encourage parents to teach their kids, maybe when they get their first ID card or driver's license, talk to them, have a specific conversation about what behavior they should exhibit and demonstrate when they do meet with a police officer. You know, comply, be respectful, answer questions, don't run. That kind of stuff. You can't legislate common sense, but that's part of what parents need to do. And I just would put also that the responsibility for a positive outcome between anybody and police officers is a shared responsibility. I think this does offer police officers some more information, the opportunity for more information, so it's a good step, and I support it.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the officer online, should this bill pass, I was hoping that he could walk me through not the full extent of the training, but basically what they would do. You know, we've talked a lot ourselves what we think that officers should do, but if he could just walk me through the process that if this bill passes, what they would do.
Officer Gayden, if you could give us a brief summary of what's done. Thank you.
Certainly, Representative Gaddis, through the chair. If I could ask a clarifying question, do you mean what we would do in regards to training or what an officer would do if they were to contact a person who had this mark on their license?
Well, I guess through the chair, I guess both, but more importantly, what you would do if you stop somebody. So what your process is when you stop somebody, certainly that goes back to being properly trained.
Certainly. Thank you, Representative Gaddis, through the chair. When we make a traffic stop, for example, we position our car so that we have a safe lane of travel to get up to the vehicle. Obviously, we've got overhead lights flashing front and rear, and we're trying to be alert to 100 different things, oncoming traffic, any furtive movements in the car, anybody, how many people are in the car, what it is they're doing, listening to the radio, and then we make contact with the driver. At that time, we would identify ourselves. Tell them the reason for the stop, ask for their license and registration and proof of insurance, ask if they had any legal reason for whatever it was that we stopped them for, and then give them a firm decision up front as to whether or not they would be receiving a citation, and ask them to please sit tight in the vehicle while we go and do any paperwork and radio checks that we would need to do during the duration of the stop.
Follow up, Representative Gaddis.
Yes, and thank you, officer. And I think the next question is, so when you stop this person utilizing all of those details that you just laid out, and you see on their driver's license that they have this sticker, what would you do different than when you just explained? What does that alert and what does it tell you? What would you do different?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, I think it would depend on what that designation indicates. Does it simply indicate that there's a hidden disability, or does it indicate with a little bit more detail what that hidden disability may be, combined with what is their behavior at the time? If they're acting completely, for lack of a better word, normal, and I hate to imply otherwise, but if there's no unusual behavior or extreme nervousness or anything like that, then we simply might ask, okay, based on this designation I see here on your license, is there anything else I should be aware of or that you'd like me to be aware of? But understanding that all hinges on the fact that we get to the license and see that designation. If they're acting extremely nervous or furtive or highly unusual behavior before we ever get to that license, we won't know what the possible cause of that is.
All right. Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think the officer answered my question in regards to it. Just I think I'm hearing him say that he will have a heightened sense that this person may have other issues that he'll ask about at that time. So it just makes him further aware that there's some recognized issues and they have that opportunity to investigate. So thank you, officer.
All right. We have one more from Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I like this bill because it addresses something that that approaches the problem from both sides, both from the officer training and from the motorist side of it. And I've been very concerned recently with making sure that our public safety officers have a adequate level of training. But to the officer on the line now, do you have any instructions to your officers when they're approaching a vehicle that has a handicap sticker hanging from either on the license plate or on the visor? I mean, is there a little training for that now? I mean, I understand that a lot of people that have disabilities that have those people get agitated when they see people just get out of their car because they might not understand the handicap or the situation that the person has. But what do you train your officers procedurally now to approach a vehicle that has either a handicap license plate or something on the visor?
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg, through the chair. Currently, our recruits here at the Academy go through an 8-hour class of crisis intervention training covering both hidden and visible disabilities and how to recognize them, how to deal with them, how to find other resources to help deal with them. And I certainly, you know, I've never spoken with our instructor on that particular topic of, okay, you see a handicap placard, does that change your approach? But I would certainly hope reasonably that it would. We like to think that our officers have common sense, some more than others certainly, but I would hope that that visual indicator, if they're indeed able to see it, would give them another clue as to this person may have some type of disability. Recognizing that those placards are given out for physical disabilities, be they hidden or otherwise, that would allow them to park closer to entrances and exits versus some other types of disabilities that wouldn't hinder their ability to get across the parking lot, for example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there further questions? Officer Gayden, I thank you very much for being online with us today and answering questions. Further discussion by committee? Rep. Sadler, will you please walk us through the fiscal note for House Bill 77?
Gladly, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 77, the CS for HB 77, has a zero fiscal note for the Department of Administration, Division of Motor Vehicles, OMB component number 2348, published 3/11/2016.
All right. Can I have a motion to move House Bill 77 from House Finance Committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for HB 77 Finance version 29-LS0072/N for November from the Finance Committee with the individual recommendations and the attached single zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Seeing no objections, we move House Bill 77 from committee, and we'll do a brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. All right, we're back on the record. Next, I would like to introduce House Bill 247, Tax, Credits, Interest, Refunds, Oil and Gas by Rules at the Request of the Governor. Here to give us a 30,000-foot overview of oil and gas tax credits are Commissioner Hoffbeck from the Department of Revenue and Ken Alper, the Director of the Tax Division from the Department. We will not hear sections of this bill today. We will have an overview of the issues that generated the legislation, and we plan on having a lot of meetings in the future on this bill, and we'll have several opportunities to discuss the bill and ask questions at future meetings. Gentlemen, if you'd please come to the table and place yourselves on the record and begin your overview of House Bill 247.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. And I just want to make just a couple of very brief opening statements, and then I'll turn it over to Director Alper to kind of give us a little bit more detail on the 30,000-foot overview. We thank you for this opportunity. This piece of legislation is critical within the governor's overall fiscal plan, both for this year and going into the future. We see a sustainable oil and gas tax credit program as vital for the state of Alaska, but the key word there is sustainable. It has to be something that we can afford to pay both in the near term and the long term. When this bill was first introduced in House Resources, we presented it as primarily a budget issue. The House Resources found it to be much more of an oil and gas tax policy issue. And so the hearings focused not only on the budget issues, but a lot of time on the oil and gas tax policy issues as well. We see this as the critical path on this is that we need to deal with both. We can't see this as just an oil and gas tax policy issue or just as a budget issue, but something that has to meet the requirements of both, because we can't offer any certainty to the industry on the tax credit program if the credits are being paid at a level that we simply cannot sustain, that we can't afford. And so that we have to have a balance between the credits that industry desires or needs in order to move some of their projects forward and what the state is actually capable of paying. Earlier in the week, you had a brief overview of the spring preliminary revenue forecast. And you saw that the department is looking at oil prices that are essentially range-bound right now, somewhere between $35 and $60 a barrel. That we see that if prices drop below $35 a barrel, essentially drilling ceases. And we see that, you know, oil come off the market, and eventually the prices would rebound from anything that would drop below that. We get much above the $55 or $60 level, we see a lot of oil come on the market, and although we might see a brief spike, that eventually the supply would overwhelm demand and prices would come back down. And I think that's pretty consistent with the thinking across the board as far as what people see in the oil industry. So when we start talking about a rebound and hoping that we get to $100 barrel oil, that does not appear to be in the picture near term or long term. And unfortunately, our credit program right now is essentially being paid out at a level that's more consistent with $100 or $110 barrel oil. And so the governor saw that as a very critical thing that we needed to deal with if we were going to have some kind of certainty within that oil and gas tax credit program. So what he put forward in the bill that was proposed was to reduce the state's annual outlay. That needs to be a very large component of the discussion. We wanted to protect the net operating loss credit program within the bill, because that came out of a lot of over 30 meetings that we had with industry over the summer, that seemed to be the most critical piece of the credit program. It's a field leveler between the legacy producers and the newcomers. We needed to have a way to limit the amount of repurchases in any given year so that we could control our outlay in any given year. We needed to strengthen the minimum tax, because in this price environment, essentially we are a gross tax state. We are a 4% gross tax state. And we need to get above $80 a barrel before that changes. and we don't see ourselves being above $80 a barrel anytime in the future. So that minimum tax really becomes the tax, and it's something that we needed to consider. We look for more openness and transparency in the credit program, just so we could have more dynamic discussions on where the credits are being spent. They are a large outlay. I think it's important that people know where their money's being spent and the type of returns they're receiving on it. And then lastly, because of the repercussions of the governor's veto last year, where he vetoed $200 million out of the package, and the essential credit crisis that created it within the industry, that we felt like it was important that we had some kind of very visible commitment to paying the existing credits so that have already been earned, so that there wouldn't be any uncertainty in the financial markets that the credits that have been earned will be paid. And so those were kind of the underlying components of the decision making when the bill was put together, and what we hope will be ultimately the final result of the bill after it works through the process. And with that, I'll turn it over to Director Alper.
Thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. Mr. Alper, place yourself on the record.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the director of the Tax Division of the Department of Revenue, and I thank you for having us here today. I know it's a long hearing. You've passed up three other bills, and we have every intention of just staying at a very high level. Hopefully, many other opportunities to delve into the deep details of the legislation that's before the committee. So if I could figure out how to work your machine. There we go. Just to give a little bit of historic background on oil and gas production tax credits, we've been in the business of paying for these things by statute since about 2007. And in that time period between FY07 and the end of the previous fiscal year, about $7.4 billion worth of oil and gas tax credits have been paid or paid through reduced taxation by the state of Alaska. You know, the biggest share of that is, of course, on the North Slope, where the bulk of the oil and gas production and the value is, with the majority used against tax liability, $4.3 billion. What that really means is that the major producers who produce most of our oil and most of our wealth are able to subtract certain credits against their tax payments before they write any checks to the state. In the past, under the era of ACEs, that was primarily the 20% capital expenditure credit. And since the transition to Senate Bill 21, it's been the per taxable barrel credit, a sliding scale credit between $0 and $8, although in the current environment, that's an $8 credit. Also on the North Slope, a very large number, $2.1 billion has been refunded. This is where the state writes checks. The legislature appropriates money every year to repurchase tax credits, and that has primarily gone to the new players in the field, the new producers and the explorers looking for and developing new oil. Looking at the non-North Slope area, and when we say non-North Slope, as a term of art, we're really talking about Cook Inlet with a little bit of what's known as Middle Earth, the interior work. There is no current production in interior Alaska. There is some exploration. Because the numbers of players and the numbers of credits are too small to be releasable without violating confidentiality law, we tend, for reporting purposes, to lump all the non-North Slope together. So when you see these, it's really Cook Inlet with an asterisk, a small amount of money going to the folks that are looking for oil in the interior area. And of that, only about $100 million has been used against tax liability. Now, part of that is because of less work, but really another part of that is there are statutory caps, maximum taxes in the Cook Inlet that were put in place in 2006 as part of the PPT bill. There isn't a lot of tax liability in the first place, so you don't see very much offsetting it because there's not much to offset against. Meanwhile, about $900 million through last year has been refunded, repurchased in tax credits, and as my next slide will show, the great bulk of that has been in the last several years. Turning on to slide number three, this is the graph of refunded tax credits by region, and the most obvious feature that you see in the graph is the growing red wedge. That's the Cook Inlet and other non-North Slope wedge. That used to be a relatively small component of the package beginning in 2012-13. It's grown. That's in many ways responding to the additional work that's been done since the passage of the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and related legislation in 2010. There's been a big ramping up of work. Some of that has had important results of resolving some of the supply uncertainty that South Central was experiencing at the time. But meanwhile, it's grown to where, of the money we spent last year, over 60% was actually outside the North Slope on refunded tax credits. And we're seeing a similar number for FY16, which is still a year in process. So moving on to slide number four, Commissioner Hoffbeck talked about this a little bit when we were on the spring forecast that was presented to the committee on Tuesday. Suddenly, the three bars, and you've seen this format before, represent the first bar is all unrestricted oil and gas revenue prior to any credits. That's a little bit of a theoretical number because we don't see that number. The middle bar, the dark green, is the actual money received by the state. The difference between the two is the money that is taken as credits against tax liability. Those are the credits subtracted by the major producers. And finally, the red bar is the revenue after the subtracting out for the fact that we're writing repayment checks, that we're paying for a certain number of tax credits. So in FY15, suddenly the oil revenue, which went down from $2.3 billion or so before credits against liability, $1.7 billion after that, the oil revenue in 2015 was only about $1 billion. Now, this is all unrestricted oil and gas revenue, royalties, corporate income tax, property tax, and the production tax. And this graph, which makes it look like FY15 is a good year, doesn't really go off to the left a little bit. If you were to look at FY12, 3 years further over, we had $8 or $9 billion worth of oil and gas revenue. So the reduction from that to two was itself a major shift of consciousness for the state of having to figure out how we're going to have a budget and suddenly switching to a world of structural deficits from a world of structural surpluses. Going down from FY15 to the present, we see things getting even worse, frankly, largely tied to the further reduction in the price of oil and the growth in the tax credit program. The forecasted number that was presented to this committee on Tuesday for FY17 is we're going to be anticipated to be obligated to about $825 million worth of refunded tax credits. And for the first time, that's a larger number than all of our unrestricted oil and gas tax revenue. So we will be functionally negative on oil and gas in fiscal year 2017 for the first time ever. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to slide number five, the commissioner talked about this a little bit. The governor, when he did that line item veto, there was no real magic to that. The number $500 million at the time, we knew that would cover everything that we had in our queue at the time, all the applications before the department. The governor's primary mission at that point was to start a conversation. He knew that this was a big issue, something that needed to be addressed. And so to do something dramatic, to start a conversation so that there would be a process leading to legislation in the 2016 session, we were taken by surprise a little bit by the degree that industry reacted to that by stopping lending, fearing that there'd be even greater cutbacks in spending in future years. The commissioner and other senior members of the administration spent a lot of time meeting with industry, assuring them that we had every intention of paying all of our obligations, that there might be some short delays as we work through a transition, but we are working towards a system that's going to keep everybody whole and that any changes to the statutes were going to be forward-looking and not retroactive. The liquidity crisis was resolved, so far as we understood. Loans were being made again, and everyone continued about their business. Meanwhile, through the previous interim, there were a lot of meetings, a lot of presentations. The first and most prominent one, there was a joint resources meeting in Kenai in June. We made a major presentation to that. Senator Giesel and the other body put together a working group of senators and members of industry. They had a series of hearings throughout the fall. We presented three times to that group with three different large, very detailed presentations on the credit structure in North Slope, Cook Inlet, and Middle Earth. Middle Earth being our term of art for the non-North Slope, non-Cook Inlet area. All of those presentations are on BASIS. I encourage members of the committee to go out there and look at them. They are easy enough to find through the Senate Tax Credit Working Group, and we can bring them before this committee, or we're going to be using a lot of the same information, but there's just a lot of detail that we were able to go into with those specialized groups in the interim. Meanwhile, coming out of those hearings and with our own discussions with the administration, we developed a reform package, a piece of legislation, including the plan for transition from the current system to make sure that there would be enough money to keep the system whole through the transition period. We introduced that legislation at the beginning of session as House Bill 247. Slide number six was really gone through by the commissioner in his introduction. These were the themes, what the governor hoped to accomplish through a tax credit reform package, reducing the outlay Protecting the net operating loss is sort of the primary surviving mother credit as a playing field leveler between the new guys and the legacy producers. Limiting our repurchases in some way, strengthening the minimum tax floor, open, transparent, and of course honoring credits earned to date. The next slide, number 7, goes into a little greater detail of what the actual concepts, what the provisions were in House Bill 247. And once again, I'm not going to drill too deeply into this because we've got plenty of time to talk about this in other hearings. A lot of the exploration credits were already scheduled for sunset. We were looking to let them sunset and transition away from direct support of exploration. The Cook Inlet drilling credits, which were very large and in some ways created at a very high level to resolve the Cook Inlet supply crisis, phase those out while retaining the operating loss. Well, we wanted to put some sort of caps on the physical repurchases, dollar values per company. There were a number of exceptions or oddities, unusual phenomena in the statute that we became aware of as we got into a low-price environment that were unanticipated. We were going to try to clean out those exceptions and loopholes from statute, and I'll go much greater detail on that later on. We also wanted to strengthen the minimum tax. What we discovered in the minimum tax conversation as we got into a period of sustained low prices, although the 4% floor does govern tax payments by the major producers, there are another circumstances where tax payments can go below that 4% number, with the most prominent one that began just in January of this year. If a major producer has an operating loss, they could use their operating loss credits to reduce their payments below the floor and all the way to zero. That was something we first became aware of a year ago. So the legislation is looking to strengthen that minimum tax, and then the governor also suggested, while we're there, let's bump up that minimum tax rate from 4% to 5%. And there were a number of other provisions with smaller dollar values associated with them, some technical cleanup of existing law, the transparency concept that Commissioner Hoffbeck mentioned, and also some reform to the interest rate structure for delinquent taxes. So that is that's the guts of the bill as we presented it. What we have, the Resources Committee, to their great endurance, met 24 times on the subject of House Bill 247 over a period of 6 or 7 weeks. We, the Department of Revenue, provided them with 5 different presentations, 5 different PowerPoints. They're all up on BASIS. I want to be working with you and your staff to determine what is the appropriate information and in what order to bring before this committee. The big concepts that were in those other presentations, the history and development of the credit system going back to the early 2000s, how the minimum tax has evolved over the years. There's actually been a minimum tax structure going back deep into the 70s and the ELF era. The various credits, how they work, how they've been used over time, which ones, for whatever reason, were never used, and what is planning to sunset, and how are those sunsets going to get built into our forecasts, status quo forecasts. Looking at the scenario analysis and what actually happens if we make certain changes, we did a lot of modeling of the more complicated, mathematically complicated provisions of our statute, of our bill, and explain them to the committee so we could walk through that deep dive modeling of the individual subsections. Also, of course, the committee substitute and the many changes made in the Resources Committee, we're going to be walking through all of those changes and how the bill has evolved. And we did, for this bill, for this project, develop a new model, what we're calling a life cycle model, that has the, rather than looking at the North Slope, say, as a whole and say, well, this is the amount of spending, this is the amount of tax, looking at it at the individual field level. If a new player comes to town and wants to develop a 50 million barrel field, and this is the assumption for capital spending, and this is the timing, and this is what the credits look like, what does the state's cash flow, both in real numbers and in discounted numbers, look like? What are the producers' cash flows, their profit and losses look in terms of net present value? And how do the changes that we're proposing in this legislation affect the profitability and the state's cash flow from specific projects? And we've done that for a lot of scenarios, and we're capable of generating new scenarios now at the request of the committee. So that is what the bill looks like at the very roughest terms. I'm happy with your say to answer some questions. If not, we could just save it for next week.
I think we're going to do that. Thank you very much, gentlemen. At this time, I am going to put House Bill 247 aside, and we will have several meetings where we'll be able to dig into the details and have a lot of questions answered. So thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
At our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for 1:30 this afternoon, and we will be hearing Senate Bill 74, Medicaid reform, and our topic will be managed care and accountable care and organizations. And with that, at 10:55 a.m., we are adjourned.